Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, October 7th, 2016. I want to extend sincere birthday wishes to my brother Dan, who's got a zero birthday coming up tomorrow, the 8th. We got a presidential debate, baseball playoffs, lots to keep you busy over the weekend. And I kind of suspected there was going to be some sort of document dump or other news event late on Friday, and I planned my day just to delay recording the podcast by about an hour. And sure enough, moments ago, the Obama White House formally has accused Russia of being the perpetrator of the hacks on the Democratic National Committee servers. Now, this is a brief announcement that I am looking at in a report from the New York Times, and no new evidence is cited. In fact, they are relying on a very weak source to assert this. He is the proven perjurer and director of national intelligence, James Clapper, who should have been fired years ago. But there he is, still on duty, riding atop our spook empire. And he issued a statement saying that the leaked emails that have appeared on a variety of websites are intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. We believe, quote, based on the scope and sensitivity of these efforts, that only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities. Now, it didn't name Putin, but that is the direct implication. And, again, no new evidence is cited. The statement said that recent scanning and probing of election systems in most cases originated from servers operated by a Russian company. Now, I remain highly skeptical. And just as the Obama administration never offered proof of who was responsible for the Sony hacks, the Office of Personnel Management hacks, and now we are supposed to rely on statements from unreliable administration officials that they know who did it, and we should simply trust them. But I have more confidence in my sources. James Bamford, the acknowledged international expert on the NSA, and two top former NSA officials, Kirk Wiebe and Bill Binney. I interviewed them in August, and at the time, Bamford had published a piece, I believe it was at Reuters, saying that if Russia had gained access in this manner, it would not tip its hand by exposing this information midstream. And so I remain unconvinced. And I fear that this is part of a larger effort to frighten the American people, to perhaps justify any hijinks that occur in the elections on November the 8th. And as you can tell, I remain unconvinced. I'm also still curious about what we learned about the collusion by Yahoo under what appears to be a direct order of the FISA court to collaborate with the NSA and the FBI, which does the dirty business of the NSA inside the United States, in order to preserve the fiction that the NSA doesn't directly spy on Americans. And what we're learning is that the custom-built backdoor into the millions of emails and the service that's used by millions of people was so sloppily installed that it posed a privacy hazard for hundreds of millions of users. Now, this is coming from a former Yahoo employee who has knowledge of the company's security practices. And this is something else that Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe and others have raised before. When you allow the government to have a backdoor into these networks, they are not the only ones who are able to knock on that door, pry it open, and get inside. So what we do know is that in 2015, Yahoo provided the U.S. government with the means to scan every single email that landed in every single Yahoo mail inbox, including yours truly. The scanning was kept an absolute secret, and we know that the security chief at Yahoo quit after he learned what was going on. Now, according to the New York Times report, Yahoo used a system that had been previously deployed to try to capture people who were emailing child pornography. and they adjusted the parameters of the search tool or the filter that they were using. And we are told that they were looking for some sort of a signature of either a state actor or a terrorist group. In any event, these are indiscriminate mass searches that are clearly prohibited by the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment does not include an exception for the FISA court. And so when Alex Stamos, who was the chief information security officer at Yahoo, quit, it is said that he took particular exception to how poorly the scanning tool was installed, quote, not from Stamos, but from an ex-Yahoo source. The program that was installed for interception was very carelessly implemented in a way that if someone like an outside hacker got control of it, they could have basically read everyone's Yahoo email. So, as you heard me say the other day, I consider this to be a constitutional crisis. This is the evidence of the police state. And many people are just kind of taking it as it goes. I don't have anything to hide. What's the big deal? But this is how we lose our rights. This is how we become captives to a police state. Barack Obama has presided over this, and I hold him personally responsible. He has constitutional law professor on his resume. And he has sold out our constitutional rights for the illusion of greater security and build a government apparatus that will not be easily dismantled. This week, we learned that at the end of August, the FBI arrested an NSA contractor who, like Ed Snowden, worked for Booz Allen Hamilton, not in Hawaii, but in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And Harold Martin has been held. Since then, we have not heard from him or his attorneys, so we only have the government side of this story to go on. But according to the New York Times, and Scott Shane is one of the reporters on this story, who I have respect for, the government is now considering him to be more of a hoarder than a hacker or a leaker. He was first suspected of being the second Snowden. They know they have a leaker somewhere in the system, who has leaked information that did not come via Ed Snowden. And now they're saying that Martin had a pattern of taking stuff home to work on, classified materials that were not supposed to leave the building at Fort Meade or wherever he may have been assigned. He's been doing it for years. In fact, the Times says that over time, Mr. Martin's methods of taking homework to his home changed. At first, he took documents on paper, later on CDs, and more recently on thumb drives, flash drives. And so this kind of shows the evolution of the practice. But they say going back to the 1990s, this is a guy who liked to take his work home with him. Now, they may catch him on some minor charges of, you know, misuse of classified information or misuse of government computers. But it does appear that this is fizzling out, and he's not the second Ed Snowden. An interesting offer has surfaced to try to break the cycle of violence in Syria, and in particular near the embattled city of Aleppo. Staffan de Mistura, who is a top United Nations diplomat for the Syria conflict, he proposed a new truce yesterday. He said, I will personally escort the Islamic State and other fighters out of Aleppo to some safe haven if the Syrians and the Russians will stop bombing. Now, both Syria and Russia have announced a pause in the bombing, but they said it was to allow innocents to escape from Aleppo before, presumably, they plan to reduce it to rubble. And I don't know if this gambit will work, but I certainly do applaud the intention. Here on the left coast, we don't have to worry about hurricanes. We have occasional powerful storms from the Pacific, and we face earthquake risk. And so, keep in mind that you're hearing from a guy who is safely out of range of any hurricane, including Matthew. And Matthew has caused problems, and as it's moving up the Florida coastline, there has been flooding and trees down and power outages, but it is not as severe and it has not caused as much damage, and I'm not aware of any deaths in the United States caused by Hurricane Matthew. But in Haiti, it's a different story. Yesterday, we were told some people had died. Overnight, the count increased to 300, and it now is pegging close to 1,000. And as you know, Haiti is one of the poorest nations in this part of the world. It has not recovered from the earthquake in 2010 and the UN introduction of cholera that followed and that continues to kill people there. And my heart and thoughts are with the people of Haiti as they try to deal with this devastation. I would just offer this advice from my comfortable perch here on the left coast. Don't send the United Nations. Don't send the Red Cross. And if you're inclined to help the people of Haiti, don't give money to the Red Cross. They've built about 6 homes with the billions of dollars they collected after the 2010 earthquake. And finally, I say don't send the Clintons. Because Bill Clinton and Hillary as Secretary of State made things worse for the people of Haiti as they came to the rescue after the earthquake in 2010. And I just want to mention that last night I went out to a movie. We've got the Mill Valley Film Festival underway here. I saw a great new movie starring Rachel Weisz, which is called Denial. It's about a court case over a Holocaust denier. Very powerful film. Anyway, I got home and wanted to catch up with the news, and all of the cable news networks had gone wall-to-wall coverage of Hurricane Matthew, despite the fact that it was after midnight on the East Coast, with power outages in many of the coastal areas in Florida. There was very little to cover. And so we had some palm trees that were lit up, and we watched them sway in the breeze, and we saw a lot of satellite imagery and weather forecast models, that sort of thing. And it really is just an example of how New York-centric and East Coast-focused America's news media are. And I recall that when Ted Turner set up CNN in Atlanta, he was trying to break that. He was also trying to break the unions, and he succeeded in that. But he was trying to get away from the idea that news only happens in New York or Washington or along the eastern seaboard. And just as somebody who is outside of that bubble, I have to point out that this storm that they were monitoring and watching and breathlessly reporting, and they sent these guys out to, you know, dance to the hurricane on television. There was a lot of speculation. And certainly it's worth covering. It's worth keeping people who are in the earthquake area apprised of the progress of the storm. But to subject an entire nation to wall-to-wall coverage when nothing is happening? That's about pandering for ratings, not providing any kind of service. Do you know who Ken Feinberg is? He looks like a mortician. He's an attorney, and his specialty is settling complex cases with many complainants or people who have made claims. And now he has been retained by the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York and its Cardinal Tim Dolan. And he has been given until the end of January to forge settlements with a number of sex abuse victims of Roman Catholic priests. And while on the surface you say, wow, they brought in this Jewish guy, he's going to be impartial. He's been told he has no cap on the settlements that he's allowed to agree to with these victims. He's been told to wrap this up by the end of January. And so on the face of it, it looks like the Catholic Church is kind of outsourcing this to a detached third party. But when you look more closely, The state of New York is thinking about there's legislation pending in Albany that would lift the statute of limitations on these kinds of sex crimes. And here in California, we just blew up the statute of limitations on rape cases. It was driven by victims of Bill Cosby. And if they did that in New York, then the Catholic Church might be open to unknown liabilities. So Cardinal Dolan is thinking like a corporate creep. He is trying to limit the damage to the archdiocese. This is the same Cardinal Dolan who was the Archbishop of Milwaukee. And he led people to believe, victims of sexual abuse, and there were many in Milwaukee, that he had their back, that he was remorseful, that he was going to make them some sort of a financial settlement. And then he turned around and took the Archdiocese of Milwaukee into bankruptcy for the specific purpose of avoiding payments to the victims of priests and sexual abuse. And so we can't trust Cardinal Dolan. And I've always been skeptical of this guy Feinberg. They brought him into the 9/11 settlements so that they could avoid lawsuits that might expose what actually happened and who was responsible for 9/11. We'll watch this one, and I'll keep you posted if I see something else. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Jeffrey Stewart, Dick Attlee, Mark Brodsky. And there's Jeffrey Stewart again, son of a gun. He's got an annual subscription that just renewed and a monthly subscription too. Jeff, my hat is off to you, and I thank you for your very generous support. I need more Jeff Stewarts out there. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, it pulls down, you choose become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and you can take out a new subscription for $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual, and you can do it faster than Who Shot Bob, as my buddies from Appalachia used to say. Sunday night, St. Louis is the scene for a town hall-style presidential debate. What that means is that real people will get to ask questions that were probably screened before they got in front of the microphones. And it might add a little different tone. Obviously, these moderators have been unable to control either the presidential or vice presidential debates from rude interruptions and people talking over one another. So we'll see if this format brings out any of the questions that never get asked by the network anchors about wealth and income inequality, about single-payer health care, about truly ending America's military misadventures in the Middle East, about restoring the Fourth Amendment. Oh, I know I can dream. It's just a daydream, and I have pinched myself. So we'll be watching. We'll see what comes of it. I want to mention one little factoid that I picked up from the PBS NewsHour last night, and that is the college in Virginia, in Longwood, Virginia, that hosted the vice presidential debate had to pay a fee of $2.5 million for the honor of holding or hosting the VP debate. The college says they spent a total of about $5 million on a one-night event. They tell us, don't worry, we got our donors to cover it. It didn't come out of student budgets. But I think that's really obscene. No one should have to pay or be able to pay to buy the right to host a debate. And it just shows the corruption of the Presidential Debate Commission that has excluded Stein and Mr. Johnson from the debates. And so here we are. And speaking of Gary Johnson, he's been fumbling his way to real embarrassment lately. And despite that, the forces aligned with Hillary Clinton have started running an ad attacking Gary Johnson aimed at supporters of Bernie Sanders and trying to convince them that Gary Sanders would be bad for them and therefore hold your nose and vote for Hillary. Now, this is a very unusual campaign strategy I have never seen in the past where the major party candidates paid any attention whatsoever or even admitted that the third party candidates existed. So the commercial says, if you support Bernie Sanders, you don't support Gary Johnson. Then that what follows is a litany of Johnson clips rattling off libertarian ideas, intercut with clips of Sanders saying no, shaking his head, and looking uncomfortable. And the ad climaxes with a checklist comparing Johnson to Sanders on the issues in which the libertarian fails each category, and Clinton passes with flying colors. I'm not sure who that's going to persuade, but there you go. I'm linking in the show file for today's podcast to an excellent commentary by Thomas Frank, a buddy of mine who is a regular contributor on this podcast. And his headline reads, "Some of Clinton's pledges sound great until you remember who's president." And he says that as a president who has accomplished little since 2011, Obama has pretty much undermined Clinton's ability to sell us on another centrist Democratic presidency. His legacy has diluted her promise. And I think this is a very interesting point, because what Frank says here is that when you look at specific issues, for example, Hillary says that she wants to use the antitrust department at the Justice Department to break up big corporations. Well, doesn't that sound nice? Well, what Frank writes is, then it dawned on me, antitrust enforcement is largely up to the president and his advisors. If Democrats really think it's so damned important, why has Clinton's old boss Barack Obama done so very, very little with it? Or take another case, and that is all of the opportunist attacks recently on Wells Fargo Bank. And Wells Fargo deserves it. There's no question about that. But Frank says that nagging voice piped up again. If Democrats think it's so critical to get tough with crooked banksters, why, oh, why didn't Barack Obama take the many, many opportunities he had to do so back in the days when it really would have mattered? And he goes on to say it doesn't really help matters to claim, as most ardent Obama defenders do, that the president was powerless before Congress. It was therefore impossible for him to do anything differently than he did during his 8 years. But he didn't need Congress to indict banksters on Wall Street. He didn't need Congress to let the antitrust division at the Justice Department do its job. No, these were presidential policies. And in his conclusion, Frank notes that Bill Clinton ran on hope, then Barack Obama ran on hope in 2008, and they've kind of used that up to the point where it's just a cliche and an empty phrase, and Hillary really can't work on the hope angle because, well, that vein has been exploited, to use a mining reference. Also, I'm linking to a piece at the Daily Beast. It is a lengthy investigative report written by Betsy Woodruff that details how, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton takes credit for opening a new era of relationships with the nation formerly known as Burma, now called Myanmar. And Myanmar has been run by generals, and there is a democratic activist, Aung San Suu Kyi. And when the Obama administration, under Secretary Clinton, opened up relations with Myanmar, they opened up Myanmar for American corporate business. And in particular, the article shows how Hillary Clinton went to bat for the international oil giant called Chevron. And like two dozen other corporations who have benefited from the opening of business in the former Burma, like Calvin Klein, General Motors, Boeing, ConocoPhillips, PricewaterhouseCooper, Gap, General Electric, Microsoft, Pepsi, Coke, Procter & Gamble, every last one of them made at least a six-figure, if not a seven-figure contribution to the Clinton Foundation. And not only that, when Hillary, so to speak, went to bat for Chevron, she ignored the call from Suu Kyi and other human rights leaders in Myanmar to block American companies from investing in the country's energy sector. They thought that would be a big setback to their cause. But the Clinton-Obama team ignored those calls, listening instead to the corporate denizens who have funded the Clinton Foundation and probably donated to both the campaigns of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. I want to commend Charlie Pierce in Austin, Texas. We've recently become friends on Facebook. His drummer, Leland Potter, has been a listener and a Facebook friend for about a year now. And they play together in a band called Choctaw Wildfire. And if you got Spotify or Apple Music or whatever you use, look up Choctaw Wildfire. I think they're a really great band, and Charlie Pierce writes the songs and is the lead singer, and I like what they do. I also like that Charlie Pierce has been standing firm with the Native Americans and other protesters of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And it turns out that the Dakota Access Pipeline is owned by a company called Energy Transfer Pipeline Projects, or just Energy Transfer, and they're based in Texas. And Energy Transfer Partners is led by a Texas billionaire named Kelsey Warren, who also plays in the music business. And so musicians have rallied around our friend Charlie, and they're protesting Kelsey Warren and a proposed pipeline in Texas called the Trans-Pecos Pipeline. And Charlie writes, "It's with a great sense of purpose and tears in my eyes that I ask you for help. I ask that we unite and let the world know that water is sacred. Water is life. Let's stand together as a music community and raise money in support of Standing Rock and all who oppose energy transfer pipeline projects, including the Dakota Access and the Trans-Pecos Pipelines." And they're planning to do, they're trying to rally music artists to do fundraisers every night in Austin to raise money and to draw attention to this purpose. So I fully support what they're doing. And if you use Facebook, I encourage you to send a friend request to Charlie Pierce and also check out the tunes of Choctaw Wildfire. A couple of interesting articles I want to recommend to you that are on the website at The Intercept right now. They just published part two of a lengthy investigation of the Chicago Police Department. The series is called Operation Brass Tacks, T-A-X, and it describes how corrupt Chicago cops were taxing drug dealers, targeting their rivals, and using all kinds of criminal methods to keep people quiet about the criminal behavior of uniformed Chicago police officers. It's a very detailed two-part study. And I hope you'll take a look at it when your busy schedule permits. Also, at The Intercept, Ryan Devereaux has written a great piece. A coalition of human rights groups is calling on the Obama administration to make good on an executive order issued this summer requiring the U.S. to investigate when civilians are harmed in lethal operations abroad, including drone strikes. In a letter sent to the White House Thursday, the groups are pressing for investigations into several specific attacks that have occurred on the president's watch. The groups who signed on include the ACLU, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Center for Civilians in Conflict. And they're in particular listing a series of attacks where we know civilians were killed in numbers greater than those that the White House has admitted to. I think this is a very important effort, and I'm glad to see it undertaken. And finally today, this week, there was an aerial survey, a reconnaissance flight over the Pacific Ocean. And they took a look at what has become known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. This is an ugly example of what we call civilization. And a lot of it are those one-use plastic bags, the lightweight ones. They don't degrade very quickly. And the garbage patch is now estimated to have expanded to at least 386 square miles, and there is debris that spans a larger area of over 1.3 million square miles. Here in California, we have a ballot measure from the plastic bag industry trying to overturn a law that was passed by the legislature to ban these single-use plastic bags. One look at the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is all I need to know how I'm going to vote on that initiative in November. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast and putting up with my scratchy throat today. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you. Until again. Happy trails.